bills in the Alaska legislature. There was another one introduced on Monday, House Bill 129 for fisheries product development tax credit. They would extend that and make it extend that. And then some of the problems that are facing us as far as federal issues, including tariffs that are kind of making everybody a little bit queasy, and retaliatory tariffs that could affect seafood. I can answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Ernie. Questions for Ernie? Okay. Charlotte.
Hey, thank you, Mayor Osterbach and Assembly. So I'll just go through kind of normal projects. My EM project is finally wrapping up. I feel like I've said this a lot, but it's actually going to be done this time. So the grant ends this month. And so I'll be just doing some closing out stuff and finalizing that grant. So I'm pretty excited. I've been working pretty closely with Cordata to make modifications to our new e-log based on a lot of fleet feedback. And I got to tell you, I've been fielding a lot of calls from the fleet to work through this DFL process. It's been a thing. So I'm kind of glad that A season is over, and I think we'll have the e-log ready for B season. So the cod tagging project, I will be on the charter, the last charter for this project, starting on Saturday, and will hopefully be done by April 2nd. I'm going with two other biologists. And as this is the final year of tagging, we actually decided to add a new station near Unimac Pass to hopefully target more of those fish coming directly through that area as they're passing through the area of fishery there. We're also shifting another one of the Central Gulf stations back to the Western Gulf to focus more on kind of what's going on in the Western Gulf. We're also opportunistically sampling more immature cod to try to help build out the maturity curve for stock assessment. We've been meeting with a lot of our collaborators to discuss potential like conceptual life history models for cod from both the juveniles and the adults, and kind of trying to figure out spawn timing and all in an attempt to understand why we have some fish that leave and some fish that stay, yet they're all genetically very similar. Ernie has submitted the Pacific Cod memo, and of course, you know, that'll go around, and we'll kind of work on that and hopefully have something in place for the upcoming deadline. And I've mentioned before, I'm also working with stock assessment authors on the federal side to figure out interim measures to sort of be able to reallocate quota between FMP management areas, which would have to happen on the federal and council side. But that won't start to happen until stock assessment season later this year, past the Board of Fish proposal deadline. Also, I've been just dealing with a lot of last minute changes and issues trying to get this charter together. So long story short, we work under a NOAA permit normally for the winter charter, but because our NOAA scientists can't travel, she won't be coming with us. So we ended up having to file for our own fishing game permit, research permit for this charter. But fortunately, we have a very good relationship with the department, and they were able to expedite our permit in just a few days, which is kind of unheard of. Moving on, so for acoustic telemetry, we did receive the two acoustic receivers that are going to go out on some existing moorings that are already in Unimac Pass. They arrived at NOAA, and we're hoping they're going to be deployed this spring. So hopefully we'll start to see some pings from cod that we've tagged. And I have received 12 acoustic tags that we're going to take with us on this winter charter and opportunistically deploy those. And hopefully we'll start to see some cod moving back and forth across Unimac Pass. For salmon projects, I have been working on a proposal for a pilot tagging study, which you just heard about. And like I said, whether that project even happens or not will depend on if the fleet really supports it, knowing all of the pros and cons and potential risks, and also if the department supports it, because it's obviously kind of a high profile project and in a controversial area. So it would need a lot of department support to move forward as well. We're working with, you know, stakeholders on upcoming proposal deadlines for Board of Fish, talking about Board of Fish strategy. I am working on uploading things to Laserfish, Beverly, if you're listening. Been working on kind of reading through some crab stuff, but I think that ended up being kind of a moot point for some of our region's proposals. Otherwise, I'm happy to take questions. Oh, and I would just note that the email came out for the 2020 PCOD disaster applications are out for harvesters, or, you know, for processors, harvesters, tenders. So that should be available online. And happy to take questions.
Thank you, Charlotte. Questions? Okay, very good. So we're down to assembly comments. You guys got anything else you want to talk about?
This is Brenda.
Go ahead, Brenda.
So I've had numerous calls with people concerned, when are the people who work in the Anchorage office going to go back to working in the Anchorage office? What do I tell them?
What do you tell them?
Yes.
I don't know. Go ahead.
So why do we rent that huge office there with all those offices in it when people aren't there most of the time?
Well, we could get a hold of Elon Musk and Doge ourselves, I guess. I don't know. I don't have any... All the work is getting done, so I haven't really pushed anything. I haven't heard any complaints from Annie or anyone. Annie, do you have any comments?
No. I mean, I've been going in pretty much every day myself. But no, I don't have any issues with anybody completing their jobs, so I've not really pressed the issue. If there are concerns, I'd be happy to hear them and talk about it. But yeah, I mean, I've been going in pretty frequently. So myself. So I'd be happy to talk Brenda offline if you'd like.
Yeah, it's not me. It's people who called me. I'll let them know.
Okay.
Other comments?
I do. I'd just like to thank Ernie and Charlotte for all the work and also the borough for trying to support some of our fisheries within the region. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Sure they do. Okay, if that's it, our next meeting date. Oh, public comments. Anybody have a public comment?
Word here.
Word.
Yes.
Your assembly comments.
So, well, I was going to talk from the mayor's standpoint of King Cole, if I could. I know it. That's why I kind of during this whole process of King Cole plant being shut down and seeing if the borough could help in any way, I knew darn well that the conflict of interest was going to be brought up. But I just want to stress that the rainy day has hit here. And I know that we do not want to, the administration doesn't want to touch the permanent fund, but then we got kind of bombed with the financial officer from the company that manages our portfolio, and then going through all of the borough obligations. That's all fine. I it's good to be refreshed there, but the thing of it is that we see that our money is going out the window. We're relying on our own reserves at the moment, and they're not going to last much longer. So, but it's just like the borough having financial obligations. Lucky enough, last year we were able to get some money from the state of Alaska for a couple of our projects and or financial obligations from Bryce and Lyman. And with all our projects going on, with our airport project and our road to Cold Bay, we had a good meeting in Juneau with the gang again this year, and they, you know, everybody's telling the same story. We don't have any money because of our permanent fund isn't performing the way it should, and or everything, the cost of everything going is going up. We get that. We know that's all happening everywhere. But one thing I see with just today here now, I don't know if it's you know, like people in the communities sometimes have to wear different hats, because people who live here, but also the people that work here, there are two different kinds there. There's people who live outside of our community. They are on our council. They are players in our community. But there's only a few chosen people that want to take part in all the governments, because it's vital to have someone who knows all the different government agencies and how to work together to get things done. And we just were at Swampsea, and we went through, just for instance, the housing in Alaska. In order to get any project done in Alaska, now you almost have to work through every government program there is, because everybody's applying for those grants for housing. So, you know, I know that in order to get anything done here now, maybe with a little bit of help for the city of King Cove, because King Cove was a big player in the borough's finances back in like the 80s. I just looked at a poster out on the wall back in the 80s of all the king crab, tanner crab, salmon into 50 million, 27 million, 43 million on the different species, not to even mention the groundfish. We all see everything turning full circle. We're trying to fight for our lives every time this fish board comes up. We can't even adjust our own fisheries because of being bombarded by the proposals against us for any type of species of salmon and or cod. But we also see the flatfish quotas going down. So, you know, we all think that the future is bleak, but then there's the optimist. We could think about the plant, if it's going to be up and running here in the next few days. I mean, not next few days, next couple of years maybe. But there is people looking. I know for a fact there is some rumors going around out there about the plant being looked at. So I think that's all I can share right now. But I just want to stress that to have the statute read in front of me here today at the assembly member meeting, thinking that I don't know about it, I do know about it. So as a council member, I still have to bring it forward to the assembly. That's why we have managers. So anyway, I think I'll leave it at that. But I am optimistic that this plant will be up and running again, and we can get off of this gloom and doom. But also, just to say, if we did get a plan going with the borough on some assistance or a strategy for the stabilization for a community in the short term, to keep some of, you know, like not getting like everybody just has to leave the community. It's going to go on a gradual stage. We know that if the plant doesn't open up, actually it's happening faster than we know it. But I hate to see it go that way, because I know in the long run, it's going to hurt our local population, because of people that are going to capitalize on everybody having to sell out this region. I don't want to see that. We have to take a look at the bigger picture. And another thing, just an observation from the mayor's standpoint here, even though I'm on the assembly, I guess I could wear two hats, but I hate to see us acting like the state of Alaska, relying on the permanent fund, making ourselves a big financial institution that cannot help a community in need. So maybe what the board members want to think about that a little bit. I want to do this in the right way. I don't want to be forceful and think that I'm going to go out of line because I have to watch my P's and Q's just because of the conflict part of it. And but we definitely want to see our resources going out of our area. I brought that up at Swampsea with our delegation on the moving fisheries offshore, which is hurting us right now, seeing quotas versus Area O versus Pacific cod on the Pacific side. The quotas are way out of balance. I mean, they're out there at the first of the year, actually like the 25th, because there's some uncaught 25th of December and 24 because of some uncaught fish that were there. So they're going pretty steady on that big fleet out there versus our, we're so damn restricted now, it isn't funny. And then you think about the like a couple of king salmon being caught in our trawl fishery ordered peacock. I mean, everybody be screaming again over that. So we really got to watch out what we're doing here, but we want to be fair to our communities. Unfortunately, we don't have a plant here right now, but I think that things might turn around there, and or we'll see our demise as it comes. But as far as from King Coast, the way things are looking here, our airport project is slated for 27. Our road to Cold Bay is on an emergency order. So that's a pretty good prospect right there. And then with the ADAC project, I think that Senator Sullivan said that he's going to have ADAC reopening in three phases. So, you know, there's I guess there might be some room to move west, but I don't even know if a processor can even participate in processing out there because it's a Navy station. So, I mean, there's a lot of give and takes. That'll bring more fish back to Dutch Harbor and or Yucatan. For who knows, you know, King Cole gets up and running, we could process any salmon here too, or any species for that matter. So I think with that, I'll let it go. And I want to thank Ernie and Charlotte again. And I voted that down just because I'm afraid of getting shot in the foot over this thing. Because, I mean, it doesn't take one little issue to turn a board or another user group or another tribal entity to come against the Area M. So anyway, with that, I'll say good evening.
Okay. Thank you, Warren. Any other assembly comments?
Move to adjourn.
I guess that was public comment. We have one more public comment. Wait.
I'll be brief. Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Assembly. This is Mike Franklin, Superintendent of Schools. First of all, thank you. I learned a ton at these meetings, truly. So a lot of great leadership and expertise in this assembly. So I appreciate all that you do. You got a lot of heavy things that came up today, and I know heavy issues you're dealing with, not just King Cove, but there's heavy times all around. And so I don't want to make light of that, but I am here to always advocate for schools. In the schools, we see and feel that heaviness, you know, not just the dropping enrollment that's as a result of the economic challenges here, but also just in the spirit and sometimes, unfortunately, lack of hope in our kids. We see it, feel it every day. So it's real in our schools. But I'm here to advocate, you know, for our schools, not just because I'm the superintendent and it's my job, but also because historically I have seen evidence that investing in schools, putting money into our schools is the most effective investment a community can make. So there is a practical payoff, I want to remind us, in schools. We know historically we see reduced crime rates when we invest in our schools. We see increased economic opportunities in our communities when we invest in our schools. We see increased mental health, increased physical health when we invest in our schools. So those are direct payoffs. In addition to just the future tax revenue that is created when we have an educated population who can be prepared for opportunities to come. The economic future and future industry in our region is uncertain, but what is certain is that an educated population is a population that's prepared for whatever opportunities arise, whether that's traditional economic opportunities here or new ones that we don't even know about yet. We want our kids future leaders here prepared for those things. So again, I just want to repeat that I always see education as an investment in the future, not just a, you know, you're not just paying for this school year when we invest in the schools. I know a lot of us here think about our schools a lot. I'm preaching to the choir, I know, because, you know, in this room are parents and grandparents and uncles and aunties of our kids. And so, you know, you have clear vested interest. But I'm here to talk about kind of the broader purpose of our schools, too. I want to remind you that Aleutians Eastboro School District currently employs close to 50 people who live in our communities, who spend money in our communities, who volunteer as coaches, as, you know, who run and volunteer our community events, the Salmon Derbies, who volunteer in EMS and other services in our communities. So investing in our schools is also investing in those people who constantly contribute to our communities. And schools, as we know, can be the center of communities. Like we just saw in the amazing, those of you who got to experience some of the girls regional tournament, saw how great a job King Cove did in throwing a, not just a party, but really celebrating our region and kids from all over the region. So I just ask that as I know you're struggling with these really heavy, hard issues, you remember that schools need to be a top priority in the borough. It is a great investment in the future. And as long as the borough continues to invest in schools, we'll continue to provide that center in the community for a long time. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Other public comments? Paul, you want to repeat that?
Yes, I repeat it.
So you made a motion to adjourn?
Yes.
Next meeting is April 10th. Are we at a motion? Thank you, everybody. Long meeting.
I don't know whether they got the second to close it out, but that was your Aleutians Eastboro Assembly. We'll get that posted up online here in just a few moments. We're going to go to a little bit of basketball here in a bit. But in the meantime, this is Virgil. This is KSDP. And we'll go back to a little bit of All Things Considered for maybe a half an hour.
The capital. The third thing that we're doing is asking them to partner with 10 historically Black colleges and universities, business programs, so students will know how to scale a business. And the fourth is to reinstate DEI, because diversity, equity, and inclusion is what really makes America great.
Now, lay out for me why you are targeting Target, far from the only retailer that is currently making a big pivot on issues of diversity, equity, and inclusivity.
Target is first and not last. It'll be first and not only. But because they are a publicly traded company, we have the open data in demographic research that Black people across the country spend $12 million a day on Target. So they're amassing that much revenue out of our community that we expect a different level of loyalty. Secondly, Target is one of the largest employers of Black people across the country. And so because we're not just consuming, but we're helping to build the company, we look for a different level of dedication.
There are a lot of Black-owned brands that are still on the shelves at Target. Have you heard from any of those people, or are you worried that your efforts might hurt them?
No. Well, 100 of those brands have walked away from Target to stand in alignment with us. A part of the Target Fast, when people go to targetfast.org, immediately upon making a commitment to be a part of the Fast, we email a digital directory as curated by the U.S. Black Chamber of Commerce of 300,000 Black businesses across the country. Many of those businesses have their wares in Target. So in no way, shape, or form do we want to have an adverse impact on minority-owned businesses. But what we are saying is that you have alternatives as to how you can support them.
Your choice of words feels intentional. We're in the season of Lent. You are calling this a fast, not a boycott. Why?
I'm taking a page from the Montgomery bus boycott that was led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. For over a year, every night of the boycott, they came back to the church for prayer and to stabilize their faith. People go to TonkinFast.org. They will receive a 40-day prayer journal. But we do understand that what we're dealing with is a spirit that is happening in this nation. That is a war, not just against African Americans or Latinos. It's a war against empathy. And anybody who is disenfranchised or marginalized seems to be put upon. So we're really praying that that spirit that is adverse to the marginalized will be overturned.
Pastor Jamal Bryant, thank you for your time.
I'm so grateful. Thank you for having me.
Jamal Bryant is senior pastor at New Birth Missionary Baptist Church near Atlanta and the chief organizer behind this fast. A note, we did reach out to Target for response. They did not have anything new to share about the story.
This week marks 5 years since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. There was uncertainty, fear, and grief, but also occasionally there were small, unexpected moments of joy. And we've been sharing some of those moments this week. Next up is Angelina Goldwell of Lacey, Washington. In 2020, she and her spouse have been looking for safe ways to get their toddler, Percy, out of the house.
You know, every time you're taking a little kid out, there was a risk, right? It's hard to go to the playground because you want them to play with other kids, but you don't want them to play with other kids right now. And so we were really looking for ways to be outside of the house, but still feel safe. We live somewhat close to train tracks, so we can hear the big freight horns go by. We decided to take a look and see if our local train station had, maybe we could just go watch them. And Percy just loved it. He would just sit on my spouse's shoulders and make those like, noises because he was so excited.
Yeah, it's come. Woo-woo. You want to get closer?
We got really familiar with the train that departed at 3:30 in the afternoon. The routine of it, the stability of it was really helpful when everything else was chaotic. Because we had been coming so much, the conductors who would wave to Percy from the window as they were departing or as they were coming in. One day, one of them had some small item in his hand that we couldn't see, and he took it and tossed it over the fence. And we caught it, and it was a little Amtrak pin that said Junior Conductor on it. It is one of Percy's prized possessions. It was a really lovely point of connection to have it be not just that we were seeing them, but they were seeing us. Trains and train watching became such a significant part of who we are that I don't know if that's ever going to stop.
That was Angelina Goldwell of Lacey, Washington, who says her son Percy now dreams of becoming a train conductor when he grows up.
This is NPR News.
The tech giant Meta gained an injunction against a former employee. She is banned from talking about her criticism of the company. But before that injunction took effect, she recorded an interview with NPR. Sarah Wynne Williams talked to Mark Zuckerberg, Sheryl Sandberg, and Facebook's values, and we will listen tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The actress Amanda Seyfried used to be known for playing ingenues. Now she's broken out of that mold.
I don't need to prove anything. I just want to do something different. I just don't want to be bored.
In the new series, Long Bright River, she gets to fulfill her lifelong dream of playing a cop.
That story's coming up after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A federal judge says the White House must offer immediate reinstatement to thousands of government workers who were fired this month. NPR's Windsor Johnston tells us the probationary employees were terminated as part of the Trump administration's efforts to slash the federal workforce.
A judge in California has issued a temporary injunction, calling the Trump administration's justification for firing the workers a sham. The employees span multiple federal agencies, including the Departments of Defense, Veterans Affairs, and Agriculture. The decision follows a lawsuit filed by the American Federation of Government Workers, which argue that the firings violated federal law. The White House is promising to fight back against the judge's ruling, calling it absurd and unconstitutional.
That's NPR's Windsor Johnston. The judge's decision came after a coalition of labor unions and other organizations filed a lawsuit over the mass firings. The Trump administration is appealing that decision. A new report from NASA scientists shows ocean temperatures rose increasingly faster than expected last year. NPR's Lauren Sommer tells us sea levels are rising as the climate gets hotter.
Hotter temperatures are melting huge amounts of ice that's stored in glaciers and ice sheets. That water is causing sea levels to rise, which have already gone up 4 inches since 1993. But last year, the oceans rose even more than expected. That's because sea levels also rise when oceans get warmer, because warmer water expands. Last year, ocean temperatures were the hottest ever recorded and drove most of the sea level rise. NASA scientists say the pace of sea level rise is increasing year by year. That threatens hundreds of millions of people who live in coastal cities. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
The S&P 500 dropped more than 10% for the first time in more than 2 years over President Trump's trade war. This is NPR. This week marks 5 years since COVID-19 was declared a global pandemic, but many patients have yet to find meaningful recovery from long COVID. NPR's Will Stone tells us they're calling on the Trump administration to make research on the condition a priority.
Research on long COVID has settled on a handful of explanations for what could drive the illness, but that hasn't translated into major breakthroughs for those who need care. As many as 18 million adults are estimated to be living with long COVID in the U.S. Dr. Monica Verduzco-Gutierrez treats long COVID patients at UT Health Science Center, San Antonio.
We need treatments, but you need clinical trials to get to treatments.
There are now dozens of these trials testing drugs, but scientists say there need to be many more. Patient advocates say the federal government needs to make sure the millions of dollars set aside by Congress supports this type of long COVID research. Will Stone, NPR News.
State officials are warning people to be aware of a growing scam involving toll road collection texts, warning not to click on any links. There's been a surge of text messages claiming recipients have an unpaid or outstanding toll, trying to get them to pay using a credit or debit card. The FBI says the scam has been reported in at least 10 states. Even those that don't have tolls have seen an uptick. The scam has also been impersonating delivery services. I'm Dwayne Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump's campaign to dismantle the federal bureaucracy is facing strong pushback in the courts. Now, some of the judges who've ruled against the Trump administration are facing online threats and calls for their impeachment. NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson reports.
At a recent hearing on Capitol Hill, Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin highlighted just a few of the critical comments coming from Trump advisor Elon Musk.
And Elon Musk has repeatedly undermined the judiciary on social media, saying things like activist judges should be removed from the bench, not to be outdone. President Trump posted, "He who saves his country violates no law."
Already this year, House Republicans have proposed impeachment against multiple judges who ruled against the Trump administration.
Since 1804, only 15 federal judges have been impeached. And as you know, the constitutional standard for impeaching a federal judge is high.
That's Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, a Democrat from California. She pointed out judges have been impeached for taking bribes, committing perjury, or engaging in corruption. High crimes and misdemeanors, she says, not differences of opinion about a particular ruling. Steve Loddick teaches law at Georgetown University.
So the more that people like Elon Musk are putting on the wall the idea that it's appropriate to attack these judges for nothing more than ruling against the federal government, the more that we're normalizing what really are, in the main, very serious threats to judicial independence.
There's something else that stands out to Vladek about the current moment. These attacks on judges are coming at a very early stage in the legal process, often before the Supreme Court weighs in as the final decider.
But one of the reasons why we don't tend to impeach judges for their rulings is because bad rulings have remedies, and the remedies are appeals.
Legal experts say the odds of a successful judicial impeachment are pretty low, and to remove a judge from the bench would require a two-thirds vote from the Senate. But Paul Grimm, who spent 26 years as a federal judge, says even the threat of impeachment can amount to intimidation.
And if you try to intimidate judges, if that's your goal, so they do not do their constitutional duty, then you jeopardize the rule of law. And without the rule of law, every liberty and every right that we cherish as Americans is vulnerable.
Grimm now works at Duke University studying the role of judges and the rule of law. He worries a lot about online posts that display the home and work addresses of judges and their adult children.
Information about where they live and where their families live, when they're subjected to hate comments on social media platforms, that crosses the line.
Nearly 5 years ago, an angry litigant shot and killed the son of Judge Esther Salas in New Jersey. And in 2023, a state court judge in Maryland was gunned down in his driveway. The U.S. Marshals say threats against federal judges have doubled in recent years, according to the most recent data. And those threats have been directed at both Democrat and Republican judges. The marshals protect judges, but they also report to the U.S. Attorney General, not to the courts themselves. And that's got some members of Congress on alert. Eric Swalwell is a Democrat from California.
A judge's security is dependent in many ways on the marshal service, who the president appoints to protect the judges. And if a president doesn't like a decision that's coming from a judge, theoretically they could pull their security.
The administration has already yanked protection this year from military and national security officials who disagreed with Trump in his first term. So Swalwell says Congress should consider giving judges their own security force, one that's independent from the White House. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Today, civil defense crews in Gaza began exhuming bodies from mass graves at a hospital to bury them in cemeteries nearby. It was an emotional moment for survivors burying their dead and for those still searching for loved ones and for closure. NPR's Anas Baba was there as bodies were being dug up. He shared his reporting with NPR's Aya Batraoui in Dubai. And a warning, this piece does include descriptions of bodies being exhumed.
There's a ceasefire now in Gaza, but grief still prevails. The smell of death is overwhelming. Civil defense workers are exhuming bodies buried hastily on the grounds of Al-Shifa Hospital during the war. The unceremonious, unsanctified sound of body bags being unzipped is a chance at final farewells. Civil defense crews say there are 160 bodies buried in this dirt courtyard that was once covered in grass and flowers. This had been Gaza's biggest and most advanced hospital until Israeli raids and battles with Hamas destroyed it. There are men, women, and children's bodies being dug up. Some were killed at the hospital in attacks. Others died as the hospital's ability to save lives collapsed. They were buried in the dirt here when graveyards couldn't be reached. Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya is Al-Shifa Hospital's general manager. He was detained for 7 months by Israeli forces in a deadly raid on the hospital 1 year ago today. Israel said the hospital was being used by Hamas. Palestinians say medics and many civilians, including patients, died in the raid. Dr. Abu Salmiya says there were even more bodies buried on the hospital's grounds, but Israeli forces took them. Israel has acknowledged taking corpses from Gaza during the war, it says, to search for Israeli hostages among the dead. Al-Shifa Hospital, like all of Gaza, bears the scars of war. Its buildings are burnt and its wards mostly destroyed. The hospital wants to use the open courtyard now for temporary clinics to serve the hundreds of thousands of people who were able to return to Gaza City during the ceasefire. It will take several more days to exhume the bodies here, many of whom remain unidentified. Sohail Sharif came here looking for her son, Jihad al-Amri. She says he was killed by Israeli tank fire as troops advanced into Gaza City. Like countless others, he was fleeing through the area with his mother, wife, and kids. She's still searching for his body to bury. He's not unknown. He's not unknown, she cries. He was my only son. I raised him on my own, she says. Gaza's health ministry says there are thousands of missing people, in addition to the tens of thousands known to have been killed in the war. Al-Sharif says she used to be afraid of cemeteries and bodies. But that was then. Now, she says, we open graves and see the dead. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with reporting by Anas Baba in Gaza.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The White House pulled President Trump's nominee to run the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a surprising setback for the administration. Dr. Dave Weldon, a former Florida congressman, was scheduled for a Senate confirmation hearing this morning, but it was canceled less than an hour before it was scheduled to start. It's an unusual move in these rather unusual times. NPR's Ping Huang is here in the studio to tell us more. Hey, Ping.
Hey, Ari.
So far, President Trump's picks for health posts have gone through. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was confirmed as Secretary of Health and Human Services, and that was despite Democratic objections. What went differently today?
Yeah, so, I mean, even just this morning, two of Trump's other picks for health posts, Dr. Marty McCary for the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya for the National Institutes of Health, both of them advanced in the same Senate committee that was set to question Weldon today. And the short answer here is that Weldon just didn't have the votes in the Senate. That's what a White House official who wasn't authorized to speak publicly told NPR. Now, Weldon was a controversial pick from the start. He had long questioned the safety of vaccines, and Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington, said in a statement today that she'd met with Weldon recently and was, quote, deeply disturbed to hear him repeating debunked claims that linked vaccines to autism. Still, the confirmation hearing was set to go right up until the last minute.
Didn't have the vote suggests that there were Republicans planning to vote against him as well as Democrats?
Yeah, so the doubt seemed to have come from several Republican members on the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor and Pensions. That was the committee that would have held the hearings. Lisa Murkowski from Alaska said that she had raised her concerns about his views on vaccines with the White House. And Weldon himself said that Susan Collins of Maine and Bill Cassidy of Louisiana were likely to vote against him, even though he had known Cassidy for years and, quote, I thought we were friends. Mm. He said that in a four-page statement that was published by the Washington Post and the New York Times. We had tried to reach out to Weldon but didn't hear back. But Dr. Georges Benjamin, head of the American Public Health Association, said that Weldon's nomination was doomed to failure in these times.
The anti-vaccine sentiment, you've got, one of the largest measles outbreaks developing, all the chaos that's going on in the federal government, including CDC at this time. When you put all those things together, Dr. Weldon was not the right guy for this job.
Now, in his statement, Weldon disagreed with being labeled anti-vax and said that he gives hundreds of vaccines every year in his medical practice. But Weldon does have a long history of questioning vaccine safety and even clashing with the CDC over it as a congressman in the early 2000s.
Well, now that he is out, where does that leave the CDC?
So it's been a lot of chaos and confusion at the agency, so it leaves them pretty much where they had been. You know, they have been facing a lot of infectious disease outbreaks without having a, confirmed leader. Some of that chaos and confusion comes from the overall churn in the federal government since the Trump administration took charge. Some of it is specific to CDC. They've been dealing with infectious disease outbreaks, and they've been hit with directives that have resulted in communications freezes, disappearing web pages, firings that have interrupted their ability to respond quickly to threats and to pursue their public health mission. And they, like most other agencies right now, are facing upcoming large-scale reductions in force, which has been another directive from the White House. So with Dave Weldon out, it's going to be up to the president to start over again, nominate someone else for the CDC director, and then we'll see what kind of vision for the agency plays out.
NPR's Peng Huang, thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Amanda Seyfried's career has transformed in the last decade. 20 years ago, she got famous playing bubbly roles in movies like Mamma Mia and Mean Girls. Now, she's known for showing serious acting chops in projects like The Dropout, where she played disgraced Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes and won an Emmy. Her new show is an 8-part series for Peacock called Long Bright River. Seyfried plays a cop and a single mom investigating a string of murders in the rough Philadelphia neighborhood where the character grew up.
3 bodies discovered in 4 days, similar demographics on the victims, and one of them might have been murdered. If there's a bad batch of something out there, then these girls need to know what it is. If there isn't, then they need to know to watch their backs.
Amanda Seyfried, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks.
You're an executive producer. Well, is it? I can't believe it's your first time. Honestly, given the number of major projects you've done, I'm a little embarrassed that it's taken us this long to have you on the show.
Listen, everything in its right time.
You were building up your whole career for this moment.
Yes, yes, exactly.
You're an executive producer as well as a star of this show. Why did you want to take it on?
I wanted to be a cop.
Really?
Yep. I wanted to put that belt on. I wanted to put the uniform on. I wanted to portray a cop. This, like,
lifelong dream career. Or woke up one morning recently and decided, like,
I think it's been a lifelong dream, and it was one of those really impossible goals for me because I was the ingenue for a long time and I just never saw myself as someone who could even pretend to have authority. So once I started playing roles, like I played a lawyer once, it almost felt like a joke. You know, it almost felt like if I couldn't believe it, how is anyone else going to believe it? And this was finally a point in my career in which I felt that I was ready to tackle this, my own internal struggle with authority and how I feel about myself. So I was like, this is a cop who's my age, has a kid, and lives in a place that very close to where I grew up. So it felt kind of natural.
It's set in this rough Philadelphia neighborhood of Kensington where your character grew up, and you grew up just over an hour's drive away from there in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Did you have a sense of what this place was like before you started working on the project?
I knew Philly. I know Philly quite well. I know certain parts of Philly. It was a cultural hotspot for me, and having grown up, like, that was the closest big city, so that we would visit for culture. But I never had heard of Kensington until, I mean, I must have been well into my 20s when Kensington was known as the hotspot for the opioid epidemic.
Right.
And I think, like most people, I only understood it for one thing. And that's part of the reason why I think Liz Moore's book, Long Bright River, did so well, is because she wrote about an honest account and a new perspective on a community that is so marginalized and so feared and avoided because of the suffering, the addiction on the streets, the unhoused people, the sex workers, and not as a community that's actually quite resilient and a community of people who protect each other and kind of move like a well-oiled machine in some ways, because they do look after each other. And so I think it was just open people's eyes to all these neighborhoods that we don't want to set foot in.
We hope it's somebody choose to live like that.
Like what?
This neighborhood used to be normal, man. We used to play baseball up here when we were kids. Sure, it was rough and tumble, nothing like this.
Yeah, well, it's got its good parts, its bad parts, like any neighborhood.
You know, your character is often the only woman in a room full of men. And the same could be said of Elizabeth Holmes, who you played a few years ago. Is there something that you especially connect with in that kind of a role?
I think I'm always trying to evolve quickly through the people I play, because I'm very well aware of the fact that I'm a people pleaser to a fault, and it gets in the way of my priorities. And it can make people in my life who are a priority feel less like a priority, because I'm so anxious and aware of what I perceive as comfort for other people. And these two women, specifically Mickey, who's based on so many real people, and Elizabeth Holmes, who is a real person, they didn't waste their time trying to make other people comfortable. They just did what they needed to do when they needed to do it. And the more I play these people, the more aware I am of my failings. And I give myself grace, too.
But it's so interesting to me to hear that these two characters who are struggling with so many problems and have so much adversity and have so many challenges are people who you, Amanda Seyfried, look up to in a way and aspire Absolutely. To be more like in a way.
Well, also, when you're acting, when you're portraying somebody, a way to honor the work at hand and to make it really count is to empathize as much as humanly possible. Of course, we all have our opinions about Elizabeth Holmes, but she's a human being, and she's not all bad. She's a three-dimensional person, and we create stories to do that, to create some kind of space for these people to exist as three-dimensional people. And even though we're trying to enhance the situation for television, mm-hmm. the point is to still kind of get to know this person in a different way.
So from where I sit, it looks to me like you have passed the point in your career where people say with surprise, wow, she can really do anything. Now it's more like, yeah, we know she can do drama and comedy and musicals, and she's good at all of it. And so now that you have cleared that hurdle, or maybe you don't feel like you've cleared that hurdle, I'm not sure, but you've played the cop, you've checked that box. Like, if all of these paths are open to you, which paths look the most appealing next?
The ones that couldn't be more different than the last character. Mm-hmm. But I do feel the respect in my industry, and it's wonderful. I don't feel like I have anything to prove. I didn't take on roles in my 30s to prove anything, but in my 20s, that's all I did. So I feel like it's been a good, you know, almost 10 years where I've had more fun and had some years I would have more opportunities than others, depending on, you know, what hits and what doesn't. It's all a crapshoot. But I always stayed true to why I made these choices. Mm. You know when something's unique.
Yeah.
And I don't need to prove anything. I just want to do something different. I just don't want to be bored.
Well, Amanda Seyfried, it has been such a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're so gentle, and I love your voice, and I love this show.
Thank you. Well, the feeling is mutual. She is executive producer and star of the new 8-part series Long Bright River on Peacock.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.